been a purposeful decision over the last 25 years to move from that reliance upon institutional services for all populations, and you'll hear more about that today. But the work isn't over, and there's still a lot of good discussion and decisions to improve the system for the future. You'll hear about waivers. Waivers are a term that, again, is part of the home and community-based system. It is not the entire home and community-based system. Waivers are part of how we're serving people in the community. There are several waivers that make up that system, and you'll hear a little bit more detail from the division directors. We're trying to do so in as cost-effective manner as possible that meets people's needs and also gives them choices, gives them an opportunity to decide where and who they want to live with. It's a large program, $3.3 billion that we administer over the course of a year through both state, federal, and special revenue funds. We have challenges. We have the age wave that we're on the verge of. Some of you may have heard some of the work around Transform 2010, where we've tried to identify some of those trends, some of those opportunities as communities, neighborhoods, the state, as well as us as individuals are preparing for later years in our populations. We have other initiatives within how we're trying to improve the lives of people with disabilities and how we're trying to honor choices and integrate those individuals into the community. Managing these programs is tricky. We've got the federal government who's giving us a set of instructions for how we can spend the money. We've got them telling us what we have to maintain, our maintenance of effort. We've got a number of pressures in terms of demographics, populations, increased needs, et cetera. And you'll see that a number of our initiatives is trying to meet that challenge. Some of the ways that we're trying to simplify and bring a better order to who's doing what in managing the long-term care system. A couple that I'll highlight that some of you have heard before would be how do people enter the system through an assessment process. MnChoices, formerly known as Compass, is a strategy to try to provide a consistent assessment process across populations, four tools currently in use into a single tool that can be help identify individuals' needs and strengths. Trying to sort through what should the state do, what should the counties do, what should health plans do. That's part of what we're working on, and we've had initiatives in the past that direct us to do so, and you'll hear some about that. Rate setting methodologies, how to better be able to match what we pay for a service with the needs of the individual. And we're taking each service kind of single by single, going through the menu and trying to design a methodology. We have on the aging side, we have a window here. About 15 years, by most demographers' guesses, that the real bulge of needs, long-term care needs, isn't really going to hit us until the demographic wave turns 75, 80, 85. And we can predict that. And that's what we're trying to do with designing some of the modifications to our system and trying to use the long-term care system to help people along the way of that aging phenomenon. I'm going to stop because I know we're on a real time challenge here, and I'm going to turn it to Alex, who'll give you a little more specificity about disability programs.
We're going to take just a moment to pass the minutes, and I think I saw Representative Quam very interested. He's reviewed the minutes thoroughly, and I think he's liking them a fair amount. There is one change he noted, though, and that's that the ending time for our meeting on these minutes was actually 4:15, not 4:49. So with that change, we'll entertain a motion to approve from Representative Quam.
So moved.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, we have approved the minutes. And Ms. Bartolik.
Mr. Chair, thank you.
Welcome to the committee.
I am the Director of Disability Services, and I'm going to give you a thumbnail of what we do. You do have information in your packets, and I want to talk a little bit about what we're where we're trying to go in the future. Disability Services does provide supports for people who need help, whether due to physical disability, developmental disability, at times with the mental health, or a complex health care needs, in order to be able to avoid institutionalization and have those, when they are needing to stay in a hospital or another setting, as short as possible. We provide these publicly funded services primarily to people who meet medical assistance standards, so they already have been found to financially not be able to pay for the services, and there are assessments that look at their functional needs and whether or not they need these services. When you go back in history, we used to have the state hospitals, and that's where many people, particularly with developmental disabilities, lived. These were state-funded, and then in the 60s, as Medicaid became more available, there were large institutional settings for people with disabilities that were state-funded or state-provided, but also in the private sector. Over time, there were many people who either weren't able to improve and get the kinds of services they need, but also families who were saying, this is ridiculous to send somebody to a state institution where I can't visit when I could help provide the care at home, but I need help. And so in the early 80s, Congress did pass the authority for states to waive some of the federal funding requiring these services to be provided in institutions and use those dollars to help support people in a number of different settings. And states just have to show what the services are, the population, that they are cost effective, and what the guidelines are going to be to monitor quality. That's the term waiver. We're waiving the guidelines around only receiving services in these settings. The four waivers that are managed through the disability waivers have similar services. They do support people in their own home, in their family home, with other people that they choose to live with, and sometimes in licensed settings. They serve people, as I said before, that have a developmental disability, physical disability, mental illness, complex health needs, traumatic brain injury, in order to help them be able to stay at home and not have to go into an institution. There's also home care services that are administered by Disability Services. These are services that are available to people on medical assistance because of a need. They're state plan, meaning if you meet a functional need for them, you can have access to them. One example is personal care services. Now, the waivers can be limited. We can decide how much money is going to be available and how many people it can serve. The state plan services need to be available to anyone who meets those needs. The home and community-based services, particularly for people with developmental disability, was a conversion of funding. We closed all those large facilities. In fact, the state a decade ago closed its last regional treatment center serving people with developmental disabilities. So much of this system is really built on public policy decisions that have been made over the past 25 years to support people more flexibly in their homes. I want to talk a little bit about some of the reform efforts. Lauren mentioned changes that are underway, and it's really important to know that our system has grown up in stages, and taking time to say what happens across populations, how can we make these programs easy to administer, how can we assure we're getting the outcomes we need, how can we assure that these programs are sustainable, are important challenges that we're focused on. Employment is a major priority for disability services. There was a time when if you had a disability, people assumed you couldn't work. There was a time if you needed benefits, you couldn't work. And that is no longer the case. You can be on medical assistance and receive some of your needed services and work and contribute as well. And there's many people who could work and be more independent overall. So we want to help people be able to work and look at how our services are structured. We've increased opportunities for consumer direction, for people themselves and their families to be able to decide what's going to work best for them, hire the support they need, being able to design their own services. It's been effective, it's been cost effective, and we want to see that continue. We've had a reliance, in part because of very heavy deinstitutionalization that required a lot of rapid movement, we've had a reliance on group home settings. These do require 24-hour staffing, and in some cases, they're not necessary for certain people. We are looking at options to try to reduce that reliance on those types of settings and help people have more individualized services in a lot of different places they would like to live, which has led to another initiative of really trying to look at housing options. How do we help people have affordable, accessible housing, and then just bring in those services that are most needed to meet their needs and that can adjust over time? We are looking at the use of technology and doing a lot of outreach and promotion of alternatives to sometimes what might be a lot of staffing by using technology in different ways, and it can also give people a lot more independence. Streamlining, making sure that we're doing the right thing for the right reasons by the right people so that we can keep our system as effective, and also quality. We are, due to some legislation that's been passed, looking at what are the quality standards that we want for our providers, and are there different ways for evaluating the effectiveness that can replace some of the current licensing activities. We're going to also be in the future going into more information about PCA. We've been doing a number of reforms to try to make sure that this service is available to help people with a strong integrity in the focus. So that's a short thumbnail of some of the direction of disability services.
Very good. Thank you, Ms. Bartolik. Mr. Held. Okay. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you.
And again, just to mention to the members, we're trying to keep questions real short. If we've got something longer, we're going to try to move that to the work groups. We're not trying to curtail good conversation, but we got a lot to get through today. Go ahead, Representative Loeffler.
Mr. Chair, this is just a really quick request. The summary material is really nice, but it shows how many people are served and how much money is spent. But many of these programs have waiting lists, and it would just be nice to get information on that as well, because I think it's important to know we're not serving everyone who qualifies at this point.
Hey, Mr. Held, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You want to state your name just for the record and then proceed with your presentation.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Bob Held from the Minnesota Department of Human Services. I'm the Division Director for the Nursing Facility Rates and Policy Division. Our division is responsible for three areas related to nursing facilities. We set payment rates. We use our role as a purchaser to leverage quality, to try to work on improving quality. And we work on policies that help contribute to the rebalancing of long-term care, shifting it more toward home and community-based services, which when people are able to be served that way, they would generally prefer. Minnesota has 381 nursing homes that are in the medical assistance program with 32,342 beds. The state has 51.1 beds for every 1,000 people age 65 and older. That compares to a U.S. Availability of beds of 43.8 per 1,000. In Minnesota, our utilization rate of people 65 and older of nursing home beds is 4.0%, meaning that 4% of all people age 65 and older on any given day are residing in a nursing home. That's reduced from 8.4%, so it's less than half of what it was in 1984. The utilization rate for people 85 and older is 15.1%, reduced from that same over that same time period from 36.4%. The median length of stay today is 27 and a half days, meaning that half of all stays are 27 and a half days or less. That's down from 41 days in 2002. In our most recent year, we had 56,000 admissions. 37% of our beds are in single bedrooms. Minnesota has a nursing home report card. It's on the Department of Health website. It's a collaborative effort between the two departments. That report card is to enable potential consumers to compare nursing homes. It's also there so that consumers of nursing homes, their families, can examine the quality that's being provided in the nursing home that they're using and advocate on an empirical basis for change. and so that nursing homes themselves can see how they compare with other nursing homes. That report card receives about 2,000 unique visitors per month. It uses a 5-star rating for each of 7 quality measures. Those quality measures are clinical quality, which consists of multiple domains and has 24 quality measures. Over the years that we've been gathering that data, 17 of those measures have shown improvement. We also measure quality of life and present that on the report card. That's done through interviews with nursing home residents. And in the 13 domains that we look at there, we've seen improvement over the years in all 13 domains. The report card also shows the findings of Minnesota Department of Health certification survey inspections. It reports on the direct care staffing level of nursing facilities. It reports on staff retention. 75% of direct care staff in the most recent report had been there for the entire year. It reports on the use of outside pool agencies, nursing pools. 68% of Minnesota nursing facilities did not use any nursing pool staff during the reporting year. Of those that did, only 1.75% of the staff were provided by a nursing pool, and that's a strong trend toward reducing the use of temporary staff over the years. And finally, the 7th measure is single bedrooms. 37% of the beds are in single bedrooms. If there's any questions, Mr. Chair.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Held. We'll keep moving along. Again, if I know this is going to happen because we've already talked about it in the previous committee, there will be opportunities to bring some of these people back and have some more extended conversations in our work groups. Ms. Wood, welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name and...
Good afternoon. Thank you. My name is Jean Wood, and I am the Director of Aging and Adult Services at the Department of Human Services. And in that role, I also am the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board on Aging. My division provides state and federal funding. We oversee, we make policy, we set rates, and we provide home and community-based services through a variety of programs, including the MA Elderly Waiver and the Alternative Care Programs, through the Older Americans Act, which we administer with the Minnesota Board on Aging. We also develop sustainable home and community-based services. And we are also the home of the Ombudsman for Long-Term Care and the State Office of the Adult Protection Services. We administer 36 grant programs with 250 nonprofit and government grantees. We work with lead agencies, meaning counties, tribes, and managed care organizations, along with area agencies on aging and numerous stakeholders. All of these functions coordinate and seek to maintain older people in their homes for as long as possible and to keep them out of more expensive care of nursing homes. I would like to touch briefly on three initiatives. The first one is the change in the MA nursing facility level of care. In 2009, the legislature passed an increase in the threshold for the nursing facility level of care, meaning that people on medical assistance would have to have higher needs in order to get either into a nursing home or into a home and community-based waiver that is a substitute for nursing facilities. We were not able to implement that because of the maintenance of effort put on us by first the ARRA and then later the health care reform bill. But we will be putting those into effect January 1, 2014 for adults and in children 2019. I'd also like to talk about the customized living rate setting tool. In 2009, you authorized the department to put in a consistent customized living rate setting tool, and customized living is also better known as assisted living. What we found was that lead agencies were not consistently applying policy, and so one of the ways of helping lead agencies was to give them an automated tool. We have implemented that tool in January of 2010. We now have a year's worth of experience with it. We are going to be writing a report about the impact of the tool, and we'll be making that available. The other initiative that I'd like to talk about is the Return to the Community Initiative. In 2010, you authorized us through our Senior Linkage Line service to work with people who were in nursing homes that had characteristics that would make them highly successful in returning to the community, but for some reason had not returned to the community. And so we are now currently following about 300 people that we have identified and talked to, and either we have followed them into the community or the person who holds their health plan has been doing that. This is not about discharge planning. This is about when they leave the nursing home, they need some additional assistance in the community to make sure that the services that they need are being provided to them to keep them in the community and stop them from bouncing back into the hospital. And with that, I end my explanation.
Thank you, Ms. Wood. Any questions? Quick questions. Seeing none, we'll move on to the next presenter, Mr. Hudek. Welcome to the committee, sir. If you could state your name and title for the record, and then...
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Bruce Hudek. I'm the Division Director of Deaf and Hard of Hearing Services. Earlier I gave a 5-minute version. Now I'm going to give you the 2-minute version. We do provide a broad range of services through our 7 regional offices. Services include in working with individuals with all aspects of their life: healthcare, employment, housing, emergency preparedness, recovery, corrections, law enforcement, and education. The regional offices also host the telephone equipment distribution program, which gives out telephone equipment to individuals who are income eligible and also have a hearing loss or a speech impairment or a physical disability who cannot use traditional phone services. In addition to this, our regional offices have an adult mental health program, and those specialists provide therapy and case management support. We also have $1.7 million in grants, which address gaps in the mainstream service delivery system and augment the regional office services that we provide. They do provide services and equipment to individuals with very complex needs. And these people are individual agencies and people who rely on sign language interpreters, children and adults who are deafblind, adults who are deaf with a severe mental illness, and children who have a hearing loss with emotional or behavioral disorder or a problem. We also provide sign language mentors to families who work with families who have a child who's recently diagnosed with a hearing loss and develop that language skill. We have 47 FTEs. 85% of those employees work with direct service. 3/4 are paid through the general fund, and the remaining are paid through special revenue. In contrast, we do have the Minnesota Commission of Deaf, Deafblind, and Hard of Hearing Minnesotans. They serve a different function than our division. They have a 15-governor-appointed volunteer commission, and their primary responsibility is to advocate for equal access for all Minnesotans with a hearing loss. They have a 3.5 FTE staff, and they're funded through special revenue. Mary Hartnett is the executive director of the commission. For us, what's important to think of the future initiative is really technology. Technology has been a wonderful asset and improved access to this community with the use of text messaging, pagers, and reading, using the use of video phones, and as well as cell phone devices have really improved the quality and access of people with a hearing loss. So that's wraps it up. It's a quick overview, and I appreciate and thank you for your time. And I look forward to working with you all.
Thank you, Mr. Hudek. Any questions? Okay, seeing none, we'll continue. Next up, we have Irvin Sullivan Sutton, Assistant Commissioner for Children and Family Services. Aaron, I'm sorry, I think I said Irvin. I meant Aaron. Welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. My name is Aaron Sullivan Sutton. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Children and Family Services at the Department of Human Services. The Children and Family Services Administration is responsible for services to promote better outcomes for some of Minnesota's most vulnerable children and adults. Our services are directed toward at-risk children and adults in adverse conditions due to abuse, neglect, dependency, extreme poverty, or disability. Thank you. And those individuals who are at risk of becoming dependent on public programs and services that are more deep and costly. We have learned, and research has demonstrated, that investing in early childhood care and development, preventing child abuse and neglect, and assisting people in meeting their basic human needs are fundamental to ensure healthy and productive citizens. We operate, have responsibility for operating child welfare programs, child care, child support, a number of economic assistance programs, community action supports. We are responsible for three of the major systems within the Department of Human Services and also have responsibility for program integrity functions. What I'm going to spend my time on this afternoon is sharing with you some of the most significant reform efforts that have been underway in the department or are currently underway. So I will do, as was said earlier, a thumbnail sketch. In doing this work, we try to balance the need to reduce expenditures and to align the limited resources that we have with those services that have proven to be the most effective in improving outcomes in the lives of people served and reducing the downward trajectory that would otherwise occur for these individuals, be they children or adults. The common themes that we look at across our program areas are the need to have flexibility to respond to the unique needs of families who come to the attention of our programs and to meet the needs of families where they are at, regardless of what door they enter the system. We need to focus on targeted and data-driven investments to be the most effective. We also see a need across program areas that families have for concrete support so that they can take care of the basic needs of their families. We also work to support and facilitate connections for people to community resources in the communities where they live. And we also work to identify outcomes and measure progress toward achieving those outcomes. Some of the challenges that we have in doing this work and learning from our reform efforts is bringing successful reform pilots to scale for at-risk children in order to reduce deep and more costly services that disrupt the development and well-being of children. That's particularly challenging during difficult economic times, as you know. We also are challenged to maintain our current critical computer systems capacity to serve clients on a daily basis while developing the new enterprise architecture that we need to serve families more holistically in the future. We have learned over the course of our reform efforts that we are most effective when we are most targeted in our efforts, and I'll give you three examples of that. Welfare reform research has demonstrated that we have the largest impact for the most disadvantaged families and that extreme poverty in the early years of life has the most adverse impact on the development of small children. And conversely, modest increases in income have magnified positive effects on children's well-being and their parents' capacity to care for them. Early childhood research has demonstrated very clearly that there are large long-term gains for low-income children when they have access to high-quality child care that also helps them be successful and ready to learn when they enter the school years. In the area of child welfare, child safety, and permanency, we have seen significant improvements in child safety and family functioning through the reform of our state's child protection and child welfare system. And that's where I'm going to start talking about some of the reforms that we have been in place in child welfare. And I know this committee is particularly interested in looking at reforms over the past couple of years, but I can tell you from experience that reforming our child welfare system has been a journey. I often tell people that we began looking at reforming our child welfare system when my daughter was 4 years old. Today she's 19 and a freshman in college. We learn each and every step of the way, and we continue to try to make more improvements based on what we have learned. For over a decade, Minnesota has been a national leader in reforming the child welfare system. The focus of our reforms have been on early intervention with families to reduce child maltreatment and avoid more costly, intensive, and intrusive services later. One of our major child welfare reforms results, which we call the Family Assessment Continuum of Response, resulted in a statewide implementation of a more flexible child protection response system that includes both family assessment and family investigation responses to accepted reports of child maltreatment. Family investigation responses apply to the most serious reports of harm and neglect to children. Family assessment, on the other hand, focuses on safety of children by family engagement and providing services to families early on so that they can safely care for their children. We also work to address those safety concerns and mitigate the risk of subsequent child maltreatment as a result of those interventions. Minnesota counties apply family assessment response to reports that meet screening criteria for accepted child maltreatment reports but don't allege substantial child endangerment. We had an intensive four-year pilot from 2000 to 2004, and that there was a rigorous field evaluation of that pilot, which I'll tell you the outcomes in a moment. That response went statewide by all counties in 2004. Approximately 70% of the reports accepted for child protection response in Minnesota are assigned to a family assessment. And what we have found is changing government's way of responding to families who are reported for abuse and neglect has made a difference. Through the rigorous field evaluation and extended follow-up study of over 6,000 families, we have demonstrated that this approach has resulted in improved child safety, reduced recurrence of maltreatment, improved family satisfaction, and increased utilization of services. What was learned through this evaluation was then later applied to our parent support outreach, which I will talk about very briefly in a moment. I should also mention, as a part of that rigorous evaluation, there was a cost-benefit analysis. And what we learned was that over a period of time, in fact, 2.5 years, for those families who were responded to with a family assessment approach, they actually cost less. They cost 35% less than families who are part of the traditional child protection process. The Parent Support Outreach Program was our next reform effort, and that is directed, it was in 38 counties, it is now in 30 counties in Minnesota. And this is a very similar response to families who are reported to child protection for reasons of alleged child abuse and neglect. However, on the day that report is made, they do not meet the statutory definition for mandated child protection intervention. But without intervention, these risk factors may be realized in a future incident of abuse or neglect. So families are approached on a voluntary basis and are offered voluntary services. Services address child maltreatment risk factors and unmet family needs that threaten the stability of the family and well-being of children. This program allows the county an opportunity to respond early to a broader set of families and to prevent the conditions that are harmful to children. Over 3,000 children and their families are served through this voluntary intervention program on an annual basis. Once again, there was a rigorous evaluation of a three-year pilot program here, and the evaluation demonstrated significantly lower child maltreatment reporting rates for families with high levels of poverty who are receiving substance abuse prevention and employment services as compared to families with these issues receiving little or no services. About 50% of the families offered services accept those services. And in addition, pilot counties experienced a significant decrease in overall child maltreatment reports in those counties making the most significant investment in PSAP, achieving a 9.6% reduction in the rate of maltreatment reports coming to their county in future years. The majority of families reported satisfaction with their involvement, and two-thirds experienced a marked improvement in the identified problems that they had. And what we learned through this and what families told us is when they were offered services, oftentimes for mental health, chemical health, or employment without the threat of losing their child, they were much more likely to avail themselves of those services. And it did, in fact, as I mentioned, make a difference.
Another significant reform effort we have had in the child welfare area is known as the Permanency Demonstration Project. And in Minnesota, we have different benefit programs for children who are in foster care, children who move permanently to adoption, and children who are whose legal custody is transferred to relatives. And essentially what happens is when kids move from foster care to either permanency with adoption or with relatives, the benefit available to the parents who are providing care is reduced by about half. The Permanency Demonstration Project allowed us to maintain a continuous benefit for those children. And the overall goal was to increase the willingness of foster parents to adopt or assume permanent legal or physical custody of special needs children out of the foster care system. The demonstration occurred in five counties in Minnesota, including our two largest counties. We placed particular emphasis on American Indian and African American children who are in long-term foster care and who had special needs. Through the demonstration, we had 60% of the children who were in the waiver group achieve permanency through adoption or arrangements with relatives, compared to 44% of children in the control group. This was particularly important for older children and children who were part of sibling groups. We recently also initiated some reform work with two of our tribes who have taken over responsibility for the delivery of child welfare services, Leech Lake and White Earth. You appropriate $4.7 million to provide a comprehensive array of child welfare services to families and children living on those reservations, and they have the capacity to access federal Title IV funding to help them. They've been operating for 3 years and continue to evolve their work. They, too, are focusing on outcomes, and they're held to the same outcome measures as our county systems. They have seen success with children who they are serving not experiencing maltreatment. They are seeing success with children not reentering care once they are reunified with their families, and also success with reunifying children safely with their families when they can do that. We have made significant gains in the adoption of children under state guardianship in the past 10 years through a number of family engagement strategies, investments in what we call the public-private adoption initiative, and a federal adoption opportunities grant that allowed us to focus intensive specific recruitment efforts for adolescents. At the end of 2010, there were 825 children under state guardianship, which was down from 1,700 children under state guardianship in 2010. Of those children who remain in care, we have 419 who are already in a pre-adoptive placement and 333 children who are currently waiting for adoption and in need of an adoptive resource. Children and youth are spending 35% less time under state guardianship waiting for adoption and have gone from waiting from 747 days to 484 days. And what you can see here is a variety of strategies that have allowed us to reduce the out-of-home placement population over the past 10 years by 40% in Minnesota and to ensure that more children have the opportunity for permanent legal families. I'd like to now turn to some of the reform efforts that we're looking at in the area of child care. There's four areas that I want to focus on. One is targeting resources to help the most at-risk children and families have access to high-quality early childhood care and education. We have a school readiness connections pilot that provides incentives for child care programs with high concentrations of family on child care assistance to serve those children, and those providers receive a higher payment, and children are allowed to remain with those providers so that they have stability and continuity in their care. We also are working with providers to improve the quality of care that they are able to provide through staff development and a number of tools directed at helping them increase their capacity to meet the developmental needs of children in their care. We have a pilot quality rating and improvement system called Parent Aware, which gives parents more information about the quality of care of early care and education programs. We worked very closely with the Minnesota Early Learning Foundation and the Minnesota Department of Education on all of our child care efforts, particularly the quality rating system. We also work with the Minnesota Department of Education and Head Start to support Head Start programs providing services for working families by braiding allowable child care and Head Start funding together so that children, again, have continuity of care. I want to mention a couple of things in the area of child support. We are working with a federal grant to simplify the process for modifying child support orders, particularly for people who don't have access to legal assistance. We're working to create an online application that individuals can use, that they will simply answer questions, and this will help them improve the process for modifying and making it much more simple for to modify a support order where that's appropriate. We are also doing a number of things to work with low-income custodial parents to help them understand the child support program and their responsibilities with child support, and to make sure that the orders are right all the time, so that if there are changes in their individual circumstances, that those are attended to right away, so that we can help prevent non-custodial parents from going into arrears, or when they do have arrears, to rectifying those however we can as quickly as possible. And of course, are working with the father's advocacy community to hear from them on what additional things we need to do in order to meet their needs as well. We recently had a couple of significant studies in the child support area. However, due to budget implications, we're not in a position to move forward the recommendations immediately. One was a study, service delivery study by Deloitte, which recommended that we needed stronger state governance and consistency in the operation of the program. We're currently working with counties, county attorneys, and county commissioners to come up with some recommendations that I expect we will share with you in the next coming years. Food support, real quickly, I just want to mention that we have waived the face-to-face interview requirements so that people do not have to come into the county office always to give the information that's needed to help determine food support eligibility. We also have implemented six-month reporting rather than monthly to make it more easier for both the administration of the program and the client receiving services. Finally, last but not least, I want to talk about Minnesota Family Investment Program, rewarding working families. Minnesota Family Investment Program provides temporary work supports and a graduated work requirements and financial incentives to give poor families a ladder out of poverty and welfare dependency. The Minnesota Family Investment Program is a work program. Employment services are mandatory. Participants are required to create an employment plan and participate 20 to 40 hours a week of work or work-related activities. And we've continued to increase the use of supported work for individuals in this program. And we measure employment and people's success. Just a real quick example, for a family of three, receives approximately $1,005 a month in benefits, including support. For an individual who is working, the parents' incomes are counted against the grant, and a family will remain on MFIP until their gross income is $1,754, or 115% of poverty, so there's incentive to work. We are also working very aggressively with the Adult Mental Health Division to provide targeted advocacy and outreach services to homeless adults with mental illness who are potentially eligible for Social Security disability benefits, so that they have the access to the resources that they are eligible for. And I know you have heard some of the work being done with our eligibility system, the MAXIS eligibility system, which is being modified to enhance its capacity to be flexible to adapt to new models of program administration through county redesign and the increase in the number of tribes who are taking over responsibility for administering these programs. And recently, the implementation of the child care, Minnesota electronic child care system, which allows for all of the child care eligibility to be determined, as well as for providers to bill payments to the system, is a part of that progress work. So that's a very quick summary.
Ms. Sullivan-Sutton, thank you. I know that's a lot to cover very quickly, and we appreciate the summary. We do have one quick question, Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Sutton, I really, really appreciate what your group does. And there's a lot of physical needs and things met. You've got vision for a future, and I just think about, you know, the teenagers, the middle school kids, they're in situations and they don't have some of the exposure and activities. How, you know, does your group, or is there another group that does something to provide them networking exposure, different experiences, so they can develop a vision for the future, goals, a dream, so to speak, to help them reach, you know, for something better? You know, there's junior achievement, there's Explorer Post, there's co-op, but I'm not sure how well they're helped in that. It's not physical, but it's, I think it's key for our young people to have a dream and goal to go to.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, thank you. We would wholeheartedly agree. And I think there's work being done in different areas of the department as well as the Department of Education. In Children and Family Services, we primarily focus on adolescents who had been in foster care and will be transitioning. And I didn't talk about all the work that we do there, but try to do a lot of work to make sure that they have opportunity for education, including one of the things we do is have education and training vouchers to help support their ability to pursue post-secondary education and work with the university system as well as others to help make that happen. And Children's Mental Health also does a lot of work with adolescents.
Very good. Thank you, Ms. Sullivan Sutton. We'll welcome Mr. Coleman. Mr. Coleman back to the committee. Thank you,
Mr.
Coleman.
Chair, I'd like to promise this is the last time you'll see me today. But I am Lauren Coleman. I am also the Interim Assistant Commissioner for Chemical Mental Health Administration for about another 10 days or so, but I'm not counting. I'll try to keep this brief. The Chemical and Mental Health Service Administration is made up of three policy divisions, including the Adult Mental Health Division, the Children's Mental Health Division, and the Alcohol and Drug Abuse Division. The administration also provides executive oversight of state-operated services, Minnesota's state-managed mental health and chemical dependency treatment services. The three policy divisions implement statewide policy for mental health and chemical dependency service, delivery, and administration, and they monitor compliance. They allocate and monitor federal and state appropriated funds to local governments and treatment providers, monitor and evaluate the performance of the local service delivery system, typically within a single county or a collection of counties, a region, if you may. They develop new programs of services consistent with research-informed and evidence-based practices and partner with other parts of the department to increase the coordination across all of our systems. Briefly, the Adult Mental Health Division is responsible to oversee and coordinate the Minnesota Community Mental Health System, implementing policy, establishing standards, rates for providers of community-based systems and services, such as case management, day treatment, outpatient treatment, intensive residential treatment services, assertive community treatment, crisis intervention, homeless outreach, supported employment, projects to assure access to underserved populations throughout Minnesota, diverse cultural and language groups, services including criminal justice, training for law enforcement, mental health courts, and compulsive gambling treatment. A number of those services are really reform efforts that have been implemented and are underway over the last number of years. There are 16 regional mental health initiatives. A lot of the work is done through grants to those initiatives. There's 87 counties, as you know, and they receive base funding for community support program services. And then tribal mental health services is funded through a federal block grant. There are strategies within all of these to really integrate mental health into physical health, really looking at the whole person and making sure that we're not missing elements of a person's life that is contributing to their need for additional services. There are about 187,000 adults in Minnesota that receive mental health services annually through these programs. Moving on, the Children's Mental Health Division is responsible to oversee and coordinate Minnesota's community mental health system serving our children. It implements policy and service standards for mental health treatment and rehabilitative services, administers grants, funding for mental health treatment services with children with psychiatric disorders, including a nearly statewide network of mental health crisis intervention services now, specializing in mental health treatment and rehabilitation. Mental health services linked to children's common environments, such as schools, screening of children and adolescents deeply entrenched in the child welfare and juvenile justice systems. Again, searching for evidence-based approaches, things that we know work better than those that don't. There are about 48,000 children in Minnesota that receive services through these programs annually. And the theme here is that, what you heard from the assistant commissioner previously is we're really trying to look at the whole person, whether it's a child or an adult, and make sure that we're not all trying to do something that impacts an individual differently. The Alcohol and Drug Abuse Division implements policy and service standards for chemical dependency treatment. It administers the Consolidated Chemical Dependency Treatment Fund and state and federal grant programs that support successful treatment. It administers grants which support statewide substance abuse prevention services and efforts, integrates chemical dependency screening, evaluation, and treatment into primary care settings. Again, where are the people that touch the system overall? It also conducts annual unannounced inspections of state-licensed tobacco retailers and an annual law enforcement survey. One of the reform efforts that is underway within that division is, again, a rate-setting methodology so that we can make sure that the money that we are paying per treatment episode is appropriate to the services being received. There are a little over 28,000 placements under the Consolidated Chemical Dependency Treatment Fund annually. The State Operated Services Division provides direct care, treatment, and support to services with people with mental illness, chemical addiction, and neurocognitive disabilities. Services for these individuals are provided by the Department of Variety of Community and Campus-Based Programs and Residences throughout Minnesota. State Operated Services also provides treatment services to persons committed by the courts as mentally ill and dangerous as a set of forensic services based in St. Peter. In accordance with the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, CMS, in accordance with their requirements, it has an advisory board of up to made up of 12 to 15 citizens, and the purpose is to advise the commissioner on specific programs or topics within the jurisdiction of the Department of Human Services relating to state-operated services. The funding for state-operated services are funded through both a direct state appropriation and we call or as an enterprise service. The enterprise service operates in the marketplace. It's just like any other provider. It has to provide the services. It has to compete. It has to receive payment just like we treat our other providers in the system. And they have to exist solely on the collection of those revenues. So they do not rely upon the state for an appropriation. Funds collected are returned to the program to fund the program's operation. Some of those programs include the Chemical Addiction Recovery Enterprise programs that provide inpatient and outpatient treatment to persons with chemical dependency and substance abuse problems. Programs are operated in Anoka, Brainerd, Carlton, Fergus Falls, St. Peter, and Wilmer. Another program in the enterprise system is the foster care services delivered to children and adolescents with severe emotional disturbances and serious acting out behaviors by SOS Child and Adolescent Behavioral Health Services. Child and Adolescent Behavioral Health Service provide these services, again, at sites statewide, and the treatment structure of the foster care home is based on a combination of evidence-based models, including the multidimensional treatment foster care model, wraparound services, and where appropriate, dialectical behavioral therapy. I hope the clinicians in the room think I got it right. State-operated services, community-based residential services for people with disabilities typically are provided in 4-bed group homes. Those individual service agreements are negotiated with counties, just like other providers, and they are integrated. Those individuals are integrated into the flow of community life, which is our goal. SOS also operates day training and habilitation programs, providing vocational support to services to people with disabilities, including evaluation, training, and supportive employment. For the appropriation programs, SOS returns any money collected to the state's general fund, and these revenues are reflected in the state's budget forecast. So, in other words, although there's an appropriation, there are still opportunities to bill for services to a third party, and as such, they do so. In 2010, SOS contributed $41 million of collections to the general fund. Appropriated programs include inpatient, outpatient, and residential services sites serving adults with mental illness, as well as inpatient services delivered by SOS's Child and Adolescent Behavioral Health Services located in Wilmer. Services for those committed by the courts as mentally ill and dangerous provided at the Minnesota Security Hospital in St. Peter is also an appropriated service. And SOS serves approximately 14,000 people during the course of a year. So that's the story about chemical and mental health services.
Great. Thank you very much, Mr. Coleman. Any questions? If not, we'll keep moving. Next, we have, I believe, Jerry Kerber. Mr. Kerber, welcome to the committee. If you could state your name and title for the record and then proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Jerry Kerber from the Department of Human Services, where I'm the director of the licensing division. The licensing division is within the finance and management operations administration of the agency, and that's an administration that provides agency-wide support to the department as well as some direct services to clients. And the agency-wide supports include things like our centralized IT, our HR functions, our financial management operations division, and within this administration, there's the chief compliance office where the licensing division sits. And I've been asked to talk about our licensing division functions a bit today, using our few minutes here, primarily because that's probably the area where most bills will touch on that you'll see this session for this administration. So for our licensing division, we perform three primary functions, and they're licensing activities, not surprisingly. There are maltreatment investigations, and there are background studies. And I'll talk about each of those a little bit. The licensing activities that we perform are basically under two models, and one is a model using state employees, and one's a model where we're partnered up with counties. For those that we use state employees, we call those directly licensed programs, and those would in those settings we have state employees who process all the applications and do all the site inspections, and we issue all correction orders, and we provide all the technical assistance ourselves to those providers. Those include things like chemical dependency treatment programs, all the way from detox through outpatient care, residential adult mental health services, any of the services for people with developmental disabilities that are licensed throughout the state, children's residential facilities, adult daycare centers, and child care centers, which is a big one. Under our county model, the counties are delegated certain responsibilities under the licensing statute, and what counties do in those cases is they process applications and they do site inspections. They make recommendations to the commissioner as to whether or not a program ought to be licensed, and then also they make recommendations if they think there's a need for a licensing sanction. Those programs include child foster care, adult foster care, family adult day services, and then family child care, the child care that occurs in people's homes. And the directly licensed programs constitute about 4,000 of our programs, and the county monitored programs are about 20,000. So all told, we have about 24,000 licensed programs. We do the site inspections under the law. We do site inspections every 2 years. We investigate in our directly licensed programs. We investigate up to about 500 complaints about services per year, and we issue about 200 licensing sanctions. The county programs, there are about, and that's done by roughly 30 staff in our division. The county programs, there are about 475 county employees who are involved in those 20,000 programs, and we end up issuing about 600 licensing sanctions per year for those facilities. Our second area is our investigations area, and primarily I'll talk about our maltreatment investigations. We receive about 4,500 reports a year of complaints and all sorts of things that people are dissatisfied with services for one reason or another. about 900 of those end up being investigated as possible maltreatment. And we heard earlier about child protection and some adult protection. Our division performs those same investigations under the Maltreatment of Minors Act as counties do for child protection, and under the Vulnerable Adult Act as counties do for adult protection. And we investigate almost in every type of license setting that we have out there, except for family child care and child foster care. County child protection workers still do those investigations. But we do about 900 maltreatment investigations per year. And of those, we end up substantiating maltreatment in about 25% of the cases. And when we substantiate maltreatment, the next responsibility we have under the law is to determine who is responsible for that maltreatment. Was it an individual, or was it the facility or the employer? And in 70% of the cases, we find that the individual was responsible. And in about 60% of those, we end up disqualifying the individual. And I'll talk about disqualification here, too. When I say disqualification, that's sort of a segue into our background study section. We also do background studies. We do, in our division, we do over 1,000 background studies a day, about 263,000 we did last year. And we do background studies on all the people who provide direct contact services in human services license programs. Almost all of them. We don't yet do them on people who provide family child care services, but the rest of the DHS license programs, we perform those background studies. We do them under a contract with the health department, and we do them on everybody who works in nursing homes, hospitals, licensed home health agencies, outpatient surgical centers, boarding care facilities. So we do those. We do them under a contract with the Department of Corrections on the people who work in their juvenile facilities. And so for those other state regulatory agencies, when background studies became, when the legislature saw a need to do background studies in those settings, rather than sort of build separate background study machines in different state agencies, it made more sense to just have the Department of Human Services do those for the other agencies, and they're all done under the same law. We also do the background studies on PCAs. And that's about getting to be about 15% of our background studies that we do. So, and we do a smattering of others. We do some for the courts on people appointed as guardians and conservators, and people appointed as guardians ad litem for kids in the juvenile justice system. And so when we do these background studies, we routinely do a record check of with the BCA, and we also check for any kind of statewide history of substantiated maltreatment of minors or vulnerable adults. And so that kind of, as I mentioned earlier, when we finish an investigation of alleged maltreatment and we substantiate maltreatment, we need to look at that maltreatment and make a determination as to whether or not it meets the criteria in the background study law for disqualification of that individual. And it has to be either serious or recurring maltreatment, as those terms are defined. We end up disqualifying roughly 12,000 people a year from those background studies that we're doing, and that's about 50 a day, surprisingly. So when we're doing these background studies, we are finding significant criminal history or history of maltreatment for the people who are seeking that employment. And then there are various appeal processes, and we process about 2,600 requests for reconsideration of a variety of those decisions that I mentioned. We have 180 requests for hearings every year. Some of those decisions we make have the people have hearing rights, and so there's an awful lot of work here that we do, and we have ongoing contact with a wide section of Minnesotans. We have nearly 2,500 people a day who are hitting on our websites one way or another. We have a licensing lookup. We have people doing background studies through our online connections. And so we're getting about 150 phone calls a day. And so we're really in continuous contact with people all around the state, whether it's family members of people receiving services or providers or employees or the employers. So we're really kind of connected up with people all over the state. So I think I'll stop there, Mr. Chair, and if there are any questions, I can try and answer them.
Any questions for Mr. Kerber? If not, thank you very much, Mr. Kerber. I know we're asking you to plow through a lot of stuff very quickly. Next we have, yes, Representative Franson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Pat Walt, and Mr. Herber. I've just got a quick question. Now, the counties take care of the daycare licensing. The state takes care of foster care licensing, correct?
Mr. Chair and Representative Franson, both of those are under the same model where
yep.
the counties do the monitoring. Oftentimes, I think there's an assumption the counties are doing the background study still for family child care, and that's probably the biggest distinction in the licensing relationship.
Okay, now for
Representative
example,
Franson.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. As a daycare provider now, I've used backup care before, and I've also used licensed foster care givers because they've already had the CPR and mm-hmm. SIDS and shaken baby trainings. Now, but they still have to do the daycare portion of the background. Is there any way that can be combined? Because I know it's kind of it's tedious. They've already done it. They have it. It's on file. I mean, is there any way we can bring those two forces together and maybe consolidate some costs that way?
Mr. Kerber.
Mr. Chair and Representative Franzen, there have been, the main issue in that case is that counties are doing one background study and the state is doing the other. And there have been bills in each of the last three sessions that would kind of make that last step of moving those county responsibilities to the state. There are many good reasons to do it. It's, you know, we can do it very cheaply. We've got a big machine built, and it would make some sense to do that. And I don't know. I think I've heard that there's going to be an initiative this year to do that, to try that again. Once we are doing all of those background studies, then I think if that bill comes before your committee, I think what we'd want to do is to talk about that and figure out a way that we can assure that background studies are more transferable, certainly transferable from one to the other, especially the situation you're describing for if somebody's had a background study for child foster care. That's a bit more in-depth of a background study than is done for family child care. And so certainly the background study that's done for foster care should cover the person for the family child care arrangement. And I think that can be worked out in the language if that bill comes before you.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Kerber. Okay, next up we have Mr. Benson. Dennis Benson with the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. Mr. Benson, we've got about 7 minutes, if we can keep it brief. Welcome
Chair,
to the committee.
I'm Dennis Benson, the Executive Director of MSOP, and we understand the time limitation. We got a very, very brief presentation here. Give you some factual information about the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. Very quickly, it is driven by statute. We are required to treat individuals that have been determined by the court to be sexually dangerous persons or sexual psychopathic personalities, SPP. Courts in, courts out for this program. We don't determine who comes, nor do we determine when they're ready to leave. We have two sites, Moose Lake, approximately 400 individuals up there, 450, I believe, and about 150, 145 down at St. Peter. Moose Lake is the front end of treatment. St. Peter is the end stage of treatment. Again, our census today is 605, but there are another 50 or so that are dually committed who are being held by the Department of Corrections in the prison system. Our annual budget is $67.4 million. And that is actually up a little from last year, but down from 3 years ago to the tune of about $7 million a year. So our population has increased by a couple of hundred, and our budget has decreased. You can see from this slide that we are still anticipating growth, about 50 a year, 51 or 52 a year, based on current practice, current trends, and current policy. We have enough beds to last us into 2013, We are having some discussion regarding bonding some fix-up money for some additional beds down at the St. Peter facility, and eventually, unless we make policy changes, we'll have to expand at Moose Lake as well. Our per diem, as you can see, has come down. Again, some of this is economy of scale, some of it is architecture moving into new buildings, and we have also eliminated about 200 positions in MSOP at the same time that the population has gone up about that same number. Our marginal per diem, every new person that comes in, costs the state about $144 a day, and then, of course, that's averaged to that $328. We spend a fair amount of time explaining why can it cost so much. We get routinely compared to the state prison system. Many of you know I spent 34 years over there. They have a per diem of about $85, $86 a day, much, much cheaper. We are mandated to treat everybody. We have about 80, 82% involved in treatment. About 80% of our budget is staffing. We have a lot of clinical staff. My clinical director will speak to that in just a moment, but that's a cost driver, and it is a treatment program. So a fair comparison is to some of the civilly committed treatment programs around the state, and they range, of course, in costs from $400 or $500 a day up to $900 a day. So we can have that discussion at a later date, but that gives you a quick overview of some of the statistics, and I will ask Janine Hebert to speak briefly to the treatment piece.
Mr. Benson, we do have one quick question from Representative Grunhagen. Representative Grunhagen.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Mr. Benson, thanks for your testimony. How do we compare to other states is one of my questions. I've heard they do, they treat these same offenders with substantially less dollars in many cases.
Mr. Chair and Representative Grunhagen,
Mr. Benson,
the range of per diems for the other 20 programs, there are 20 state programs and a federal program that's just getting started, range anywhere from, in Florida, it's very, very cheap, around $100 a day. California, the last we heard, was up over $600 a day. Wisconsin, our neighbor, is around about the same number we are, right around $300, give or take a few bucks. There's a wide range. The thing I would caution, and we are doing a survey as we speak to get better numbers around this, but everybody keeps score a little bit differently in terms of how they do civil commitment. There are outpatient civil commitment programs. Pennsylvania, for example, just civilly commits juveniles. So it's very, very difficult to get an apples-to-apples comparison. Wisconsin has a lot of similarities to our program. We like that program. We visited it several times. We have consulted with them on numerous occasions, and I think the statute is actually, there are similarities between their statute that drives the program and ours as well. So that is a program we know a lot about, and again, we're very close to them in terms of our cost. The other problem we have is we have two sites, and it's difficult to, every time you have a second site, you need a new boiler man, you need a janitor, you need cooks, you need to recreate that infrastructure, and it's a very small population. But we have two sites because of beginning stage and end stage of treatment.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, just one follow-up.
Representative Grunhagen, quick follow-up.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Benson, it just seems strange to the average person out there that we spend more on a sex offender in the state, than we do for our Alzheimer's patients. And the sex offender, you know, can dress himself, toilet himself, feed himself, et cetera, and the Alzheimer's patient in many cases can't. So it does seem, on the surface at least, as a layperson, that things are out of balance. Thank you.
Mr. Benson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Grunhagen, I appreciate that concern, and I think it's a fair question and a valid concern. I can tell you again, though, that while certainly Alzheimer patients are surrounded by medical staff, we not only have medical staff, we have an aging population, but we are required by law and by licensing to have X number of clinical staff available to treat these individuals. In addition to the treatment component, we also have the security component. We all know that occasionally these folks try to get out of the facility, so we have another additional expense in the area of custody and security. Again, we have brought that number of staff down by a couple hundred. If we go any further, I believe we will have issues with the court. We already are being challenged by patients with respect to what we are and aren't offering today that we did 5 years ago.
Representative McDonald, quick question, then we have to keep moving.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Benson, you mentioned that you were on the DOC as well, Department of Corrections. Last week at the public safety meeting, they mentioned that that they do have a sex offender program in one of the facilities, and they were able to do it for approximately $103, approximately. You mentioned the $89, but actually with bricks and mortar, the bonding, it equals about $103. So just curious, perhaps their program is different than yours, but that is could be a significant savings over a long period of time. Your per diem of $144, their per diem at the Department of Corrections for the same for a sex offender is $103. So just wanted to get your opinion on that, and that certainly is comparing apples to apples because we're within our own state, or is it not?
Mr. Benson.
Mr. Chair and Representative, to some degree it is fair. I can tell you that the licensing that drives sex offender treatment in the Department of Corrections is also different from our licensing. I would caution, though, that remember the custody piece of that per diem is averaged in with 9,500 offenders. In other words, their food bill is $3.28 a day because they're buying potatoes for almost 10,000 offenders. Their medical costs are much cheaper because they're able to buy in bulk. Where on our side of the house, we have 600. We have two sites, and we don't have 1,000, 1,500, 2,000 bed facilities the way that we did in corrections. So many of those costs are averaged across 10,000 offenders when we're averaging our costs across 605 clients. So that is a cost driver. The other thing I would say is we are compelled to treat 100% of the people who want treatment. Corrections treats about 17-18% of the sex offenders, so that also is a cost driver.
Representative Norton.
Yeah, just quickly, Mr. Chair, because it hasn't been touched on, although perhaps it's going to be soon. We see a line going up, and one of the things that we've talked about over the past years that maybe some of the new folks haven't heard is how many people actually leave the program every year or don't leave the program every year, that it doesn't necessarily rotate as even other types of facilities have a rotating population. Ours does not, and maybe that could be expounded on just a tiny bit for the new folks.
Mr. Benson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Norton, again, another issue that this committee and others, I'm sure, will continue to examine. We have not had a successful release from this program since its inception. Had one individual who was out for several months, violated the conditions of the release, came back. We believe that we are on the precipice, finally, of certainly the Supreme Court is going to consider two individuals this spring for provisional discharge. Again, it's up to the courts to decide when they are ready to be released. We make some recommendations around that, but it is a court-driven process. I can tell you that out of 4,500 sex offenders in civilly committed programs, I believe less than 10% have been released nationally. So we're not alone in our plight to try to get somebody out there successfully. Remember, these are the 600 probably most challenging sex offenders to treat in the state of Minnesota.
Ms. Ebert, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Janine Hebert, and I'm the Executive Clinical Director of MSOP, and I will cruise quickly through these slides, and if there's questions, we can certainly address them in another setting. Before we talk about the treatment, I'd like to provide a little bit of overview of context for who our clients are and what we're talking about. MSOP is one piece of a comprehensive component for managing and treating sex offenders in Minnesota. And if you think about, there's 16,000 known registered sex offenders in Minnesota. And at any given time, in a snapshot of time, there's about 85% of those, 80% of those are in prison. They've either been on probation, violated, went to prison, or went directly, 80% of them are in the community. They either were placed on probation or did time in prison and are back out in the community. About 15% or 10% are in prison, and MSOP has 2-3% of registered sex offenders. So when we're talking about all of sex offenders, now the ones that we have made it through the funnel of that upside down triangle. So the ones that we do have of the 600 have earned their way to us. They are the highest risk sex offenders and have been placed there by the courts. This is just the continuum that explains how we get these clients, and their clients, when they come to us, they're no longer inmates. Those are the corrections folk. The Department of Corrections refers cases back to the counties for consideration with regard to SDP or SPP commitment. And so it's up to the counties to determine if they pursue those cases and if, in fact, they end up being committed. About 50% of the cases that are referred by corrections to the counties end up civilly committed as SDP, SPP. In Minnesota, once you're committed, every 6 months you can appeal a petition to the Special Review Board, which is a three-person panel, and you can create a petition for a placement in a less secure environment, provisional discharge, or full discharge. In the case of our clients, that recommendation from the SRB then goes to a three-judge panel. It's referred to as SCAP, the Supreme Court of Appeals panel, and those three individuals are the ones that render an opinion based on that petition. So when Dennis says courts in, courts out, it is up to this ultimately this three-judge panel to make determination with regard to provisional discharge or full discharge. This is an overview, briefly, of what treatment looks like at MSOP. Mr. Benson said about 80% of the clients that are at MSOP are currently participating in treatment. Just like any kind of psychological change, you can't force someone to do that. We try to cajole and manipulate and encourage people to participate in treatment appropriately, but ultimately folks have the right to refuse. The two bars up on the left-hand side of the purple here are the Moose Lake facility. That is our reception facility. Individuals come in the door up at Moose Lake. They're on hold until that legal process has been completed and then are invited to participate in treatment if they do become committed. We have a three-phase treatment program. The first two phases about are completed up at Moose Lake. So primary treatment, taking a look at the underlying issues, why people committed their offenses. We utilize polygraphs and penile plethysmographs and ABLE assessments. We can talk about that another time. But we do outside assessments with our clients to validate and confirm their self-report. If they are successful and progress through treatment, they are then transferred down to St. Peter. St. Peter has a twofold mission. One is that it provides all of the treatment for our alternative population, and those are individuals with compromised executive functioning. People who are lower functioning may have traumatic brain injury, neurological issues, something that prevents them from being successful in a conventional program. All of that population is down at St. Peter. The remaining clients down in St. Peter are those who are furthest along in treatment. They're in the third phase of treatment, which is the third box there. Once individuals get to St. Peter and they start to progress through their privileges, in which point they are allowed to walk on campus escorted by staff, the next level is that they are permitted to go in the community escorted with staff, and then the third level of privilege is to walk on that St. Peter campus unescorted by staff. All of the clients at MSOP have ankle bracelets, and so we monitor them through the ankle bracelet as well as covert surveillance. Those decisions for the first three steps are made programmatically by the clinical team. In order for clients to make it to that fourth step, which is the community preparation service, that is the programming outside the secured perimeter down in St. Peter. And that decision has to be made by the three-judge panel. So clients need to petition for that. They go through SRB and they go through SCAP. We have currently seven clients. This is as of January 1st, which it says six, I believe, but we do have one more gentleman. So we currently have seven clients who are doing programming down in St. Peter on the St. Peter campus outside the secure perimeter in the housing, which is staffed 24/7. Of those clients, as Mr. Benson referred, we have two that have petitioned to the Supreme Court of Appeals panel, and they will be considered for provisional discharge. Both of those clients are supported by the treatment team, and so those petitions will be considered in the next few months. And where we go from there, we'll see what the courts say.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to our guests. Since we went through the developmental disabilities and mental health section fairly quickly, I'm just wondering, where does the responsibility lie, if it does lie, in DHS in terms of looking at long-term prevention, in terms of early identification of people at risk, appropriate early intervention? Because I know I've heard that a significant part of your population actually is developmentally disabled, and it does seem to me like you're dealing with a growing population. We ought to see what we can do in prevention and diversion earlier.
Ms. Ebert.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's an excellent question. Thank you for asking that. In 2008, Mr. Benson and myself came over to MSOP, and there was restructuring that happened as we were pulled out from underneath state-operated services. And in that process, we have done some restructuring and have developed one full-time position which is dedicated to prevention. And we also have now a research and assessment unit, which is an opportunity for us to look at who we have and see if we can find clues from individuals that ended up with us to go backwards to find the other end of that continuum for prevention. So I believe it's, quite honestly, it's a professional obligation of ours. We have an immense opportunity to do that research and to influence the field to see what we can do about decreasing our growth with regard to civil commitment. So we have a full-time person who's working on that, who will work with other projects across the state and connect some dots and coordinate that. There's a lot of initiatives going on. But sometimes I think that victim and prevention things get lost. We're the ones that tend to get the spotlight, and we should to some degree, but there's another side of that spectrum that we need to consider, which is prevention.
Thank you.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just briefly, Mrs. Hebert, did I pronounce that correctly?
Hebert, yes, thanks.
I know, I'm sure, and I presume that you do great work for the offenders. Last time you were here, you referred to them as clients, and this time as well, I'm compelled to at least say I don't think that's the correct term for these offenders, to call them clients. That's my own personal opinion. I know we don't have time for my question even, but I don't think they should be called clients. They're offenders for a horrible reason. I have clients in my business. Those are not clients in my opinion, so that's all I have to say, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Mr. Benson.
Mr. Chair and Representative McDonald, very quickly, from a clinical perspective, we've had this debate in committee for 2 years now, and we've kind of gone back and forth on this. We went from they were patients. We don't think that that's proper. It doesn't accurately define the relationship between the therapist and the individual. So last year, we changed the terminology in statute to civilly committed sex offenders. Statute refers to them as civilly committed sex offenders. But from a client or from a clinical perspective, it makes sense that they are their client in that treatment world. So from a policy perspective inside of the facility when we're running groups, the clinical staff refer to them as clients, but the statute now is very clear that they are labeled civilly committed sex offenders.
Thank you, Mr. Benson. Ms. Ebert, right? I'll have to remember it for the next time you're with our committee,
thank you.
So I pronounce it correctly. Thank you. Mr. Lights is up. Scott Lights, please come forward. We have about 10 minutes left. I realize this was originally a 25-minute portion of the presentation, so you have my apologies, Mr. Lights, but please state your name and title for the record, and then please proceed.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Scott Lights. I'm Assistant Commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Human Services over healthcare programs. We recognize your time is short, and so we'll be very, very brief. I think you have a handout of our presentation, which just has the full presentation. I think what I'll do is touch very briefly on the programs that we operate in the healthcare area, and then I'll ask Shannon McMahon to very briefly touch on the various operational aspects of the agency's healthcare programs. Minnesota has a large and complex array of public health care programs funded either jointly with the federal government or solely by the state. We collectively call these programs the Minnesota Healthcare Programs, and they include the Medical Assistance Program, the Minnesota Care Program, the General Assistance Medical Care Program, and a number of other special programs. Medical assistance is funded by a combination of state payments from the general fund, federal funding received under Medicaid and the Children's Health Insurance Program, and it covers populations with joint and state funding of children under the age of 21, pregnant women, parents, persons who are age 65 or older, blind or disabled, and adults without children, effective March 1st of 2011. To put it in perspective, those first three categories that I mentioned, children under age 21, pregnant women, and parents, represent about 69% of medical assistance enrollment and are about 27% of the costs for the program. The majority of the costs in the medical assistance program is in the for persons over age 65, the blind or the disabled. The Minnesota Care Program is funded through a combination of state payments from the Healthcare Access Fund, enrollee premiums. All enrollees in Minnesota Care pay a premium, starting at $4, and then there's a sliding scale above that based on income, and federal funding received under the Prepaid Medical Assistance Project Plus, or PMAP Plus waiver, and CHIP. Minnesota Care populations who are jointly federal and state funded include children under the age of 21, pregnant women, and parents. The General Assistance Medical Care Program, or GAMC, is fully state-funded from the general fund and covers individuals who are low-income adults without children, below 75% of poverty, ages 21 to 65, and who do not qualify for federally funded health care programs. As I mentioned, that program, GAMC, will be replaced in March 1st with medical assistance enrollment for those populations. Eligibility for Minnesota's healthcare programs is determined on a variety of financial and non-financial factors, such as the income of the individual, assets, citizenship or immigration status, disability status, state residence, and living arrangements. Collectively, for fiscal year 2010, medical assistance enrolled a little over 600,000 people on an average monthly basis, spent about $7.2 billion. Minnesota Care enrolled about 132,000 people and spent a little under $700 million, and GAMC spent about $300 million, covering approximately 35,000 individuals in Minnesota. I'll turn it over to Shannon to briefly go through the operational aspects.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and proceed.
Mr. Chair, members, Shannon McManam, the Chief Administrative Officer of the Healthcare Administration, and I'm going to quickly walk through our actually six divisions that we have that run the healthcare programs that Mr. Leitz just outlined. First, our Federal Relations Unit. They're a team of folks, some attorneys, some policy folks, who do work in relationship with the federal government. They are specifically involved in our compliance work, identifying our federal authorities, our work around the Medicaid state plan, the waiver from Minnesota Care, as well as other waivers that are run both in the chemical and mental health area and in the developmental disabilities area. I'm going to skip ahead to slide 15 because I think that might be an area of interest for this committee. You've heard a lot about the maintenance of effort requirements that are a part of the ARA and that were also a part of the ACA. And this slide sort of details those requirements that as an agency, programmatically, we cannot make changes to the Medicaid program for children up until 2019 and for the existing program until we have the health insurance exchange operational. And so these next two slides kind of go through those issues. We are, as you move through the session, happy to provide advice and counsel to you and your staff about your proposals and how that fits in with the ARA and those maintenance of effort requirements.
And members, these are on pages 5 and 6 in your handout.
The Healthcare Eligibility and Access Division does really two key things. They're involved in both administering the program and doing policy development work, and then also they are responsible for administering the enrollment and eligibility determinations for the Minnesota Care Program. We are processing over 90,000 Minnesota Care cases. On average, we're hovering around 8,000 to 9,000 Minnesota Care cases that we're processing per month right now, which is a substantial increase over where we had been just in the past couple of years. We have over 45,000 people come to our office on Cedar Street and have direct assistance there, able to pay their premiums and turn in their applications there as well. The Health Services and Medical Management area, I'm on slide 21, is run by Dr. Jeff Schiff. I think many of you know him.
It's page 7, members.
And he does a lot of the benefit coverage policy, has worked on some of the pharmacy policy, does rates for the ambulatory services, so outpatient physician services, and is also working on care delivery design, healthcare home, many of you who've been around know about that work, and implementing the accountable care organization and risk sharing initiatives that were passed in the last few years in your omnibus bills. Our healthcare operations area does direct work with enrolling providers, and we are maintaining the operational components of the state's health. We're the largest health plan in the state, and so we are making payments to providers. We are handling claims, doing benefit recovery work, and in, as I said, enrolling and working directly with providers. I'll skip ahead to managed care purchasing and payment. Slide 31.
That starts on the bottom of page 10, members.
This area is responsible for administering the non-fee-for-service area of purchasing. We, managed care area, we also do rate setting for hospitals, FQHCs, IEPs for school districts, and again, we negotiate the managed care contracts in this area. We were also, that area also was involved in negotiating contracts for the CCDS arrangements that were enacted last year for the delivery of the General Assistance Medical Care Program. And finally, last but not least, the Performance Measurement and Quality Improvement Division holds the Ombudsman Program for state managed care and does direct work with clients, helping them navigate the managed care programs. We have run the managed care help desk there. We get nearly 80,000 calls per year at that help desk. Also in the performance measurement areas, the maternal child and health delivery and health program quality, and perhaps the last area that they're involved in is surveillance and integrity. Program integrity is handled in the performance measurement area as well.
Ms. McMahon, that's amazing. That was very...
I do my best.
Very good. Members, I want to call your attention. We will have other opportunities to go over these things too, but there are a number of handouts, obviously, much like the previous committee. I'd encourage you to spend some time going over them if you don't already know these programs. Some of you are very familiar with them, others are not, but... we also have a couple of handouts that were passed around today. One of them I want to call your attention to. There will be a tour of Boston Scientific, their Maple Grove facility, from 9 to 10:30 this Friday morning. I understand there will be transportation from the building here. Not quite sure how that's being arranged. Maybe watch your emails about that. There was also a handout from the Department of Human Services. Disability Services Division, in response to Representative Loeffler's request, that was handed around during the meeting, and then Representative Huntley also passed out some information about health improvement programs among employers and their efficacy. Members, if we have nothing else, we are adjourned on time.